Welcome back. This is Rick Hogan doing his new 5-7 shift, and it is a pleasure to have these next two guests on. They are the authors, and the ladies, Corey Rumer Finley and Marianne Mather, are colleagues of mine at the Tribune. I say still colleagues, even though I don't see you guys anymore. They're both they both live in Chicago. They both have wonderful families, one of whom I know. This book, he had it coming, Four Murderous Women and the Reporter Who Immortalized Their Stories. It is a book, but it's also some, to me, it is some kind of almost a multimedia experience. The writing is fantastic, and I'm going to praise you on that. But also the way in which it is designed and laid out and the use of photographs and archival material. Is this how you, and I think you, Marianne, were digging in what is called the morgue at the Tribune in 2017. You came upon those pictures and you came upon a story and you said to Corey, hey, you want to work on a story together? This cannot possibly be what you conceived of when you first said, hey, you guys, you want to work together on a book?
Yeah, I think we were a little unsure in the beginning what we wanted to do with the material that we had found.
Yeah.
You know, here we had, I mean, we just had a wealth of stuff in front of us. You know, we had 75 glass plate negatives. We had news clippings. We had, I mean, it was just, the Tribune had collected all of this stuff. It was just waiting for us to do something with. And I know Corey and I kind of banged our heads together and said, you know, what should we do? You know, does this go in the, just in the newspaper? Do we put it online? And then together we just decided this should be a book.
How did you conceptualize the book then, both of you? I know, Marianne, you're a photo editor, the precise title's the photo editor, and Corey, you're a graphic artist there. Did you go to Agate Publishing, to Doug, and say, hey, we have an idea for a book. How can you help us put this into compelling fashion? That's generally not the way it happens. Maybe it happened that way for you guys. You got lucky.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Corey, you can speak to that.
Yeah.
Oh, just a little bit, just a little bit. But it's so nice to chat with you guys again. But yeah, we had no concept at first that it would become a book. In fact, I found an email in trying to brush up on this story for the first time in months of, you know, I was looking through my old emails, and I emailed Marianne in December of 2017, and I said, I had so much fun chatting with you about this because, yeah, I was heading. The good thing is we both love sweets.
Yeah.
And so there was a holiday potluck in the fourth floor newsroom at the
the good old days. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. The good old days when we could see each other and eat together and talk things out. And I mean, if there were any case to be made for how important a newsroom is.
Yeah, no kidding. No,
we will eat anything, and we love to talk. And so she actually brought up these photos to me in December, and I just immediately had goosebumps. And I found an email that I sent her the next day, and I said, I can't wait to work with you on this. Maybe we can run it in the next couple of months on the Chicago Tribune's website. So,
mean, yes.
Right. Well, and I think we got so excited about it that we pitched it to Agate, which we don't normally do.
Yeah, sure.
So we went to them and said, look, we've got this wealth of stuff, you know, all of these tactile things, and we'd really like to, you know, make people realize this historical moment in time, and they loved it. So we just ran with it, and, you know, of course our editors were wonderful and said we could do it. You know, we don't always have enough time to do it, but yeah, they gave us the green light, which was awesome.
Well, the hook, of course, being you could toss around the fact that the book formed the base of the book, and it sort of formed the basis of a very famous musical and a very famous and popular movie of relatively recent vintage. That obviously helped sell good old Doug Siebold and Agate the value of this. I think the value of it is so much deeper. I think it really, what happens in this book and what happens to these ladies really echoes in these times. Don't you, not talking specifically about COVID or rioting, but more about Me Too, but don't you find that to be true?
Yeah, we felt like we found these at the exact moment when they needed to be found.
Yeah.
You know, the stories of these women and how you know, they used their appearance, but how their appearance was also used against them, and how, you know, they did live in a man's world. In 1924, each one of these stories and their backstories of Beulah and Ann and Belva Gartner, the Roxy, Hardin, Velma characters, how they grew up in maybe abusive relationships and had, you know, they didn't have the best lives, and you see how that came forward in 1924 and got them in possibly the situations they were in. So, definitely.
The book, the first page of the book, the title page of the book has beautiful, stunning, and to me, haunting portraits of these four women who were highlighted in the book. One of them, you know, notoriously and famously beautiful, but each one of them, there's something that really... Tell me if I'm wrong or I've lost my mind during this COVID stuff, but they really, these photos haunt me. They really do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll stop Gavin and let you talk, Corey, in a minute, but the one photo that when I first found the first box of these women was Catherine Balick or Baluch, which is, but we call her Kitty Mall because that's what she went by. But the first photo, the first glass plate negative that I held up to the light was her clutching her daughter in a jail cell. And I thought, oh my God, what is this? You know, it's gripping and it's not glamorous and jazz handy like we think of when we think of the play or movie Chicago.
Yeah, right. Well, let me ask you both, and we'll devote the next half hour and give you both on till 7 and thank you and tell your husbands and kids.
Thank you, Rick.
Rick's a nice guy. Yeah. Rick's a nice guy. He once gave you a donut or something. I want to talk a little about you both, as I know you, and I don't know you as intimately as I would if the Tribune had been open for another year. you both have a palpable passion for history and what history is represented by the newspaper files, don't you? Could you each tell me where that... I do too, of course, but how was that born? Corey?
Oh, wow. I've always had an interest in history and looking back to history to see how people in similar situations handled those situations. So I've always kind of been a digger. The first I can remember is digging at the newspaper I worked at in Tucson, Arizona, the Arizona Daily Star, where you had archives from, you know, shootout at the OK Corral.
Wow.
And I believe one of my colleagues back then found a meatloaf recipe by Linda Eastwood, who would become Linda McCartney. So,
well,
I love just the breadth of stuff you can find if you're willing to dig and if you're willing to get a little bit dirty and have some patience and try to piece together not only what the image is showing you, but what it is. I mean, one of the things we haven't mentioned yet is when Marianne found these glass photo negatives is a lot of them had absolutely no information with them about who these people were other than the names on the outside of the boxes. So it took Marianne so much digging just to make the connection of who was this person represented in this photo clutching her child. So, I mean, that's the part that gives both of us goosebumps, I think. It's just, it's an investigation.
Yeah, you become sort of private detectives. You have to investigate these things. But also, I think some people don't realize and it's vanishing all over this country, that there one day there's not going to be old clips stored anywhere. And I think, you know, in the old days when I went to go to the Sun-Times and or Tribune archives, I'd go to get a specific clip of something and would wind up being in there for 4 hours looking at all these other clips and going in all sorts of different direction. And it's a different... It's vastly different than being, looking something up at Wikipedia and being drawn to something else at Wikipedia. It doesn't work for me. Now, Marianne, you too, I mean, you have found for me, for some of my stories, some remarkable photos.
Yeah, half the fun is finding them, really, and just being able to bring them to light and being in when we were in Tribune Tower in the subterranean vault, you know, you're down there and it's cold and it's, you know, you have no Wi-Fi. So if you ever want to find out who somebody is, you have to run back up, you know, 5 stories to use your laptop again. But I do think that digging into these archives. I'm not sure how I started doing it.
Yeah.
I know that my mother's a librarian, so maybe that,
gave
me some sort of background into, into really being meticulous with metadata and trying to figure out, you know, everything's place. And for the Tribune, I mean, they have just this vast, you know, glass plate archive and acetate negatives. Those are the next in the 1930s and such archives. And of course, the news clippings. So to have all that at your fingertips, you know, you said it yourself, I can go down there and look for one thing, and I will be there for hours finding other cool stuff. So.
Well, and you've done, the fact that this, this remarkable book, and I will use that word over and over, He Had It Coming, Four Murderous Women and the Reporter Who Immortalized Their Stories by Corey Rumer Finley. How come Finley's not on the jacket cover, Corey?
You know, I'm sure my husband asked the same question.
Yeah, I would too. I would too. I'm not being sexist here. I thought, maybe they inked the deal long before you were married. And Marianne Mather, who has a husband, who I know, Brian, you guys must be really, really proud. You may have had some, come on, Doug Siebel, do it this way kind of conversations, but you've got to be happy. This is literally one of the most beautiful books I've ever put in my hands.
I appreciate you say that, and I think surprisingly, I mean, I've done several books for the Tribune, and this one wasn't a huge ordeal to produce. It just trying to produce it while doing your regular work as a newspaper person, you know, that takes a little bit of extra time. So I know Corey and I put in some extra long days, and then the
I'd see you guys in there on the weekends a lot. I go, What are you working on?
Yeah.
You are two of my favorite people, two people I admire tremendously. We're going to devote the next, after the news, the next 15 minutes to, if you would, for me, detailing the lives of these four murderous women, which are detailed artfully. How'd you guys write this book? I know you got idiots like Chris Jones, Heidi Stevens, Michael Phillips, and me.
And don't forget you.
I'm not the biggest idiot of the bunch to contribute various things for perspective, but I got to tell you, the writing in here is fantastic. Your writing in here, and I want to know, in 30 seconds, how'd you do that?
It's all Corey.
Lots of research.
Okay. They're both so self-effacing. Just talking to you guys, it renews my faith in the newspaper business. Believe me, I miss seeing you guys. We'll take a break here and get some news, and then it will be the three of us and five other women for the last half hour of this show. We'll be back. Welcome back. I want to read something from this remarkable book, He Had It Coming, Four Murderous Women and the Reporter Who Immortalized Their Stories, written by Corey Rumer, R-U-M-O-R-E, Finley, but it's Corey Rumer on the cover. Maybe you could search it that way, and Marianne Mather. I wrote in here, ladies, and thanks so much for coming on. This is really. I'm not kidding. You renew my faith in newspapers. I wrote about that women being sort of unusual characters to be accused of murder, mostly men who do that dirty deed. I write that you read that women. They compromised Murderous Row, a then new section of the county jail reserved for women waiting to stand trial for murder. In 1924, there were more than a dozen women there, most accused of killing a husband or lover. And thanks to the deep and vivid archives of the Chicago Tribune, you will see them too, in addition to the four main players here. And this is one thing, I had no idea. In general, the mood from cell to cell was sunny. The women received fan mail and flowers. Some cut one another's hair, gave one another manicures, and discussed cosmetics and fashion. These, quote, damsels, unquote, did not feel in any great distress, knowing there was a long-standing tradition of all-male juries failing to convict attractive females of murder, despite what was often a mountain of evidence. There are four. You do detail the lives of more than four, but there are four principles in here. Might you two ladies divide them and tell the listeners who they were and their stories?
Well, sure. Do you want me to start, Marianne?
Yeah.
Sure.
You're so good at it.
Well, let's see. So The one thing we need to say overall is that the biggest shocker to me is this: Chicago was written by a former Chicago Tribune reporter.
Very I'm going to devote the last 15 minutes of the show to her.
Yeah.
Because she is as fascinating a person as I've always thought she was interesting, and you two make her just even more mysterious. I'll start this off. There's a reporter covering these women for and the trials for the Chicago Tribune, and she would shortly leave, and she would use some of what she had her reportage as the basis for a play, movie, musical that was Chicago. How's that? Basically the two lives, principally two of the four lives that you guys detail. So let's start with the two who became in the play, Roxy and remind me.
And Velma.
Yes. Okay. Do Roxy.
We'll start with Roxy.
Thank you.
And she's the most exciting one.
She is the most exciting and gorgeous. I mean, the one thing we can't show you on
radio. Yeah, that's the failing of radio, man. I'll tell you that. It's the failing of radio.
That just means, you know, the listeners will have to go to ChicagoTribune.com and order a copy of it themselves.
Yes, perfect, anyway, perfect.
So Beulah Annan is just this gorgeous woman with these clear blue eyes and auburn hair.
Yep.
And she had already been married twice and became a mother by the age of 24, but she was a Kentucky native, and she ended up in Chicago with her second husband, who was a mechanic. And while he was away at work, she was bored. And so she gets a job at a laundromat, and wouldn't you know, she meets a guy. And while her husband's away toiling hard to make money to bring home to her, she's messing around with this guy. And so a lot of what the Roxy Hart character is based on, actually, it happened according to what we have been able to find on our own newspaper's clipping. So one afternoon, it was April 3rd, 1924, the husband's away, and Harry Kalstedt comes over. They get drunk, and somehow a revolver gets pulled out, and Harry gets shot by Beulah Annan.
In the back. Don't forget that.
Yes, of course not. Okay. Yeah. Let's have another one of these characters. What about... go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say that we dub her, the Chicago Tribune dubs her, quote, the prettiest woman ever accused of murder in Chicago. So,
she was pretty. She was pretty. She was pretty and dangerous, no doubt, but awfully, awfully pretty. Next of the four...
You want to do Belva now?
Belva.
Yeah, we'll go with the inspiration for Velma Kelly. This is Belva Gardner. She was the daughter of a Civil War veteran who lived in Southern Illinois, comes to Chicago and very young, and had been married several times when she was young. She actually was married to a guy named Gardner He was German. He was a native of Germany who moved here and started a scientific company that still exists. I think it's based in Skokie now. So anyway, she's married. She has all of these lovely things, a lovely home and horses. And the guy that she ends up meeting, Walter Law, is dropping off a new car for her. And so kind of similar to Beulah's story, she is taken up with this other guy who, of course, he's married and has a wife and a child, of course. But they also go on these trips around the city to go drinking and dancing. And wouldn't you know,
during
one
prohibition.
Yeah, there's a lot of drinking in this era, too. I mean, there's a lot of drinking surrounding some of these murders, too.
Yeah. Absolutely. So this guy ends up with a gunshot wound to his head and a bottle of gin nearby, but then Belva takes off.
Sabella Niddy is one of the most interesting-looking people I have ever encountered, as are her daughters, Philomena and Mary. What was her crime?
Well, she was...
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Marianne. This is you.
Well, Sabella is one of the most interesting cases that you see in the play Chicago. She is an Italian immigrant. She was a farmer's wife. I think she had a pretty hard life. Her husband all of a sudden disappears. Mm-hmm. And her sons say, Mom killed Dad. So the police bring her in. There's no body. They can't figure out what happened to him. The sons say Mom did something to him, and she gets convicted and sentenced to death in 1923. Mm-hmm. The body does eventually show up, by the way.
Right. Right.
So the problem is that she didn't speak English. She didn't write or speak any English. She was convicted, sentenced to death by hanging, and she didn't understand a word of anything that happened in court. And so it's a really sad story.
Oh, it's terrible. Tragic.
Yeah.
Tragic.
Yeah. And you realize, you know, the sentence gets overturned by the Supreme Court eventually, but not until a team of Italian attorneys come to help her on her behalf. And, you know, not before they also had to kind of upgrade her image a little bit for the press to make her, you know, more likable, if you will say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the final of the four?
Kitty Malm or Catherine Balick or Balouk. Mm-hmm. We're not really quite sure how some of these women had their names pronounced, but she was a 19-year-old Hungarian immigrant. She had a child, had been estranged from her verbally abusive husband. She was very young. She got mixed up with a man named Otto Malm, who she called her husband. Mm-hmm. They were not married. He was a convicted murderer, and one night they decided to go break into a sweater factory in late 1923, and there was some security guards there. Shots rang out. One of the security guards dies. You know, the Otto Malm, her supposed husband, says, well, I didn't do it. She did it, and points Catherine out. And so, you know, he's already been convicted of murder once. He doesn't want to hang, so he pins it on her, which is pretty much what you can see along the plot of how her story goes. So she's convicted and sentenced to life in prison and actually ends up dying in prison. And it's a very sad story to see for a woman who's so young and didn't have education or money or any way to present her image in a better light to the courts or the press.
In Living, thank you both for detailing the sort of Cliff Notes version of these lives. In living with these women for as long as you did, and I mean living with them in print and in photos, did you feel close? Did you get an emotional tie to them in any kind of fashion? You must have. I sense it in the way you talk about them.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
I know Corey probably felt closest to Maureen. I think I might have felt closest to maybe the two underdogs, Kitty and Sabella. I think for me, just seeing the trials and how every step of the way their image affected what happened to them.
No question.
It was just awful, like reading that and being part of seeing that story play out.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the book. We're going to take a short little break and come back with the woman who fascinates me more than most women I've ever met. And that's saying something. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. Maureen Watkins is the reporter who was hired by the Tribune and spent only a few months, less than a year, working for the paper. This is how she is captured initially in He Had It Coming, Four Murderous Women and the Reporter Who Immortalized Their Stories by Corey Rumer Findlay and Marianne Mather. You got a piece of an interview that she conducted in 1928. For some magazine, I think it was called Success or something, and here's what she says. I wrote a letter to the city editor of the Chicago Tribune, and he asked me to call. The first question he shot at me was whether I had any experience or had ever worked on a newspaper before. I told him I hadn't, and he wanted to know what made me think I could work for one now. That flustered me a bit, and a little too frightened to answer, I arose to go. But he snapped at me to sit down and gave me the job. That encounter is one of the most remarkable encounters I've ever heard of. It's like,
it's
Stanley and Livingston. It's. Did that not shock you two?
It's shocking. Let's just face this, okay? That's how she got a job, no experience, comes to the Chicago Tribune as a female, as a woman.
Which was a rare commodity at the time. Don't you both? Did she become a heroic figure to you, or an enigmatic figure? An enigma is obviously part of her charm and mystery, but do you admire her? You have to.
Oh, absolutely. For me, I mean, this was her only journalism job.
I know.
Only professional journalism job ever, and she started at the Chicago Tribune, and she was in Chicago working at Standard Oil, working in the advertising department. But when I tried to find if there were any personnel records whatsoever, going back to the 1920s, for the Chicago Tribune, there just aren't. Nothing exists.
Nothing.
So
it's zero.
Take that interview, is what actually happened.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just can't even imagine getting a job with, she was a playwright and not having really any journalism clips or chops to show for it.
No, she also told that same magazine, Success Magazine, years after her time in Chicago, "I got so I prayed for murders. Not that you ever have to pray long for murders in Chicago, but I prayed for good murders. And then I prayed that I would be sent to cover them." That's another thing that's remarkable, that she was sent to cover these, because I guess, the men felt it somehow below them to deal with women killers, I guess. What do you guys think?
Well, that's our thought, is that she got assigned to Murderous Row because none of the men wanted to do it. They didn't feel that, maybe they felt it was below them at that point, but she did actually write one story for the Leopold and Loeb murder.
I know.
So that's a pretty big deal. So that was what I would assume would have been a male-dominated beat right there.
No question. Yeah, trial of the century, for God's sake.
Exactly.
She also, thank you too so much for uncovering her. When she died, sort of lost and alone in 1969, the Tribune did not even run an obituary of this woman who had grand success. But she could write. Here is a lead, I suppose. "Beulah Anand, whose pursuit of wine, men, and jazz music was interrupted by her glibness with the trigger finger, was given freedom last night by her, quote, beauty proof, end quote, jury." You must. Coming upon her would be like, I don't know. Honestly, God, I don't know what I would compare it to. I simply don't know what I could compare it to. It would be like, being in a cab in 1963 and having the driver say, "Yeah, I do a little bit of writing," and the driver is Mike Royko and gives you a great column. She did have astonishing success with the play, which it's still another interesting thing that it premiered before the ultimate Chicago newspaper play, the front page. But her fading, you do such a wonderful job of making me sad in the section called Fading from View. You write, "Following a long illness, Maureen's beloved father died in February 15th, 1941, and then you detail how she and her mother traveled to Missouri to attend the burial, how telegrams, and she stopped writing plays and traveling the world. She was no longer mentioned in Hollywood stories and made no public comment following the 1942 release of Roxy Hart, the 20th century film starring Ginger Rogers. You must have, you two, whether over drinks or somewhere, you obviously still wonder what happened here.
Corey and I talk about this all the time. Yeah. I mean, I think Maureen is the enigma for us, and it's probably really difficult. It is very difficult for us because we'll never know in her head at times. And we've tried. Corey tried harder than I did. She really tried to get every detail.
You have her handwritten will here from 1969, and this has this inspired? I never thought about this with all our COVID time on our hands. Has this inspired you two to do any kind of fictional speculation about the fate of Maureen Watkins?
Oh, yes. that's a good question.
Yes, Rick, we have a one-act play. It's premiering on Broadway. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that would be fascinating. I mean, this is a woman who, she was an only child.
Yeah, never had a family.
Yeah, she was raised outside of Indianapolis. Her father was a minister, and apparently she was extremely close with her father.
Sounds like
and
it.
And after
like
he
it.
Died, all I can assume, and Maureen herself was never married, never had yep. children herself. Yep. So I can only assume that after her father passed away, and she ends up moving to Jacksonville, Florida to live sometimes with her mother, sometimes in the same building as her mother. I can only assume that really affected her.
Whew. It is a real tragedy. It was Chicago the Musical is the second longest running show on Broadway behind Phantom of the Opera, for goodness sake. The movie was a huge hit. What you women have captured here is one of the great Chicago stories. You even found the 3-sentence-long obituary that ran in 1969, never mentioning the play. It says, Miss Maureen D. Watkins of Jacksonville died Sunday in a local hospital following a lengthy illness. Miss Watkins was born in Lexington, Kentucky. She was a playwright.
That's it. And not even in the Tribune. That wasn't in the Tribune.
Yeah, I know.
We never...
Yeah. Yeah. What has been... I hope the response from editors at the Tribune was not, hey, you two girls have spent too much time with this. But it was...
we might have.
Yeah, I'll bet. You must have gotten... And it's too bad that the book came out... It came out... And there were a few copies available, and then it came out again, and now COVID has struck, and you two have not been able to do the kind of book promotion that one should be able to do with a masterpiece like this. Do you have any regrets? Or are you happy with, not about life in general, ladies.
I was going to say, what kind of regrets are we talking
about? Life in general. I mean, you're so passionate and articulate and powerful when you talk about this thing that my regret would be that you didn't have the chance to take it to the stage, even if the stage is in a library or a bookstore.
Yeah, I think that kind of hit us a little bit. You know, COVID did put a damper on us being able to do a lot of different events that we had set up, whether it was at libraries or on the stage. We had a festival that we were going to be going to that was about Chicago. So those things obviously got canceled, and that was sad. But, you know, we're constantly trying to find new ways for people to be able to see the book and learn the stories. So, you know, we'll just keep at it. That's all we can do, right?
Well, you can't go down in the basement. You can't go dig in the morgue, can you now, or can you?
Oh, I still dig in the morgue.
Do you?
We still go over there.
You should look for me. Chris Borelli is sometimes sitting up there doing whatever he does, but I've come in the office a few times during this whole COVID thing. But you do, in so many ways, renew my faith in newspapers by reminding me of what treasures newspapers were and in many, many ways still remain. I hope to, Corey Rimmer Finley and Marianne Mather, I hope to see you one of these days and
Same here. Yeah. We love you. We can't wait to see you again.
Love to your families too.
Thanks.
To Brian, who used to be my personal floral guy.
I know.
There's a play in that too. There's a play in that. Thank you both. Take great care. Be safe and be well. Will
you? Thank you, Rick. You too.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
Good night.
Good night. Again, that's really an amazing. It's an amazing book. It's only $35, and it's like walking in a wonderful historical gallery, and it's all filled. It is what newspapering was, and it is what in Marianne and Corey you have two of the finest newspaper people I have ever known.